Jesus and slavery. There was one other issue I wanted to raise with Carson. I glanced at my watch. "Do you have a few more minutes?" I asked. When he indicated he did, I began to address one more controversial topic. To be God, Jesus must be ethically perfect. But some critics of Christianity have charged that he fell short because, they say, he tacitly approved of the morally abhorrent practice of slavery. As Morton Smith wrote, "There were innumerable slaves of the emperor and of the Roman state. The Jerusalem temple owned slaves. The high priest owned slaves. One of them lost an ear in Jesus' arrest. All of the rich and almost all of the middle class owned slaves. So far as we are told, Jesus never attacked this practice. There seem to have been slave revolts in Palestine and Jordan in Jesus' youth. A miracle-working leader of such a revolt would have attracted a large following. If Jesus had denounced slavery or promised liberation, we should almost certainly have heard of his doing it. We hear nothing. So the most likely supposition is that he said nothing." How can Jesus' failure to push for the abolition of slavery be squared with God's love for all people? Why didn't Jesus stand up and shout, "Slavery is wrong," I asked. Was he morally deficient for not working to dismantle an institution that demeaned people who were made in the image of God? Carson straightened up in his chair. "I really think that people who raise that objection are missing the point," he said. "If you'll permit me, I'll set the stage by talking about slavery, ancient and modern, because in our culture the issue is understandably charged with overtones that it didn't have in the ancient world." I gestured for him to continue. "Please go ahead," I said. Overthrowing oppression. In his book, Race and Culture, African-American scholar Thomas Sowell points out that every major world culture until the modern period, without exception, has had slavery, Carson explained. While it could be tied to military conquests, usually slavery served an economic function. They didn't have bankruptcy laws, so if you got yourself into terrible hock, you sold yourself and/or your family into slavery. As it was discharging a debt, slavery was also providing work. It wasn't necessarily all bad. At least it was an option for survival. Please understand me. I'm not trying to romanticize slavery in any way. However, in Roman times there were menial laborers who were slaves, and there were also others who were the equivalent of distinguished PhDs who were teaching families, and there was no association of a particular race with slavery. In American slavery, though, all blacks and only blacks were slaves. That was one of the peculiar horrors of it, and it generated an unfair sense of black inferiority that many of us continue to fight to this day. Now let's look at the Bible. In Jewish society, under the law, everyone was to be freed every jubilee. In other words, there was a slavery ban every seventh year. Whether or not things actually worked out that way, this was nevertheless what God said, and this was the framework in which Jesus was brought up. But you have to keep your eye on Jesus' mission. Essentially, he did not come to overturn the Roman economic system, which included slavery. He came to free men and women from their sins. And here's my point. What his message does is transform people so they begin to love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love their neighbor as themselves. Naturally, that has an impact on the idea of slavery. Look at what the Apostle Paul says in his letter to Philemon concerning a runaway slave named Onesimus. Paul doesn't say to overthrow slavery, because all that would do would be to get him executed. Instead, he tells Philemon he'd better treat Onesimus as a brother in Christ, just as he would treat Paul himself. And then, to make matters perfectly clear, Paul emphasizes, "Remember, you owe your whole life to me because of the gospel." The overthrowing of slavery, then, is through the transformation of men and women by the gospel rather than through merely changing an economic system. We've all seen what can happen when you merely overthrow an economic system and impose a new order. The whole communist dream was to have a revolutionary man followed by the new man. Trouble is, they never found the new man. They got rid of the oppressors of the peasants, but that didn't mean the peasants were suddenly free. They were just under a new regime of darkness. In the final analysis, if you want lasting change, you've got to transform the hearts of human beings. And that was Jesus' mission. It's also worth asking the question that Sowell poses. How did slavery stop? He points out that the driving impetus for the abolition of slavery was the evangelical awakening in England. Christians rammed abolition through Parliament in the beginning of the 19th century and then eventually used British gunboats to stop the slave trade across the Atlantic. While there were about 11 million Africans who were shipped to America, and many didn't make it, there were about 13 million Africans shipped to become slaves in the Arab world. Again, it was the British, prompted by people whose hearts had been changed by Christ, who sent their gunboats to the Persian Gulf to oppose this. Carson's response made sense, not only historically, but also in my own experience. For example, years ago, I knew a businessman who was a rabid racist with a superior and condescending attitude toward anyone of another color. He hardly made any effort to conceal his contempt for African Americans, letting his bigoted bile frequently spill out in crude jokes and caustic remarks. No amount of arguments could dissuade him from his disgusting opinions. Then he became a follower of Jesus. As I watched in amazement, his attitudes, his perspective, and his values changed over time as his heart was renewed by God. He came to realize that he could no longer harbor ill will toward any person, since the Bible teaches that all people are made in the image of God. Today, I can honestly say that he's genuinely caring and accepting toward others, including those who are different from him. Legislation didn't change him. Reasoning didn't change him. Emotional appeals didn't change him. He'll tell you that God changed him from the inside out, decisively, completely, permanently. That's one of many examples I've seen of the power of the gospel that Carson was talking about, the power to transform vengeful haters into humanitarians, hard-hearted hoarders into soft-hearted givers, power-mongers into selfless servants, and people who exploit others, through slavery or some other form of oppression, into people who embrace all. This squares with what the Apostle Paul said in Galatians 3:28. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Matching the sketch of God. Carson and I talked, sometimes in animated tones, for 2 hours, filling more tapes than would fit in this chapter. I found his answers to be well-reasoned and theologically sound. In the end, however, how the incarnation works, how spirit takes on flesh, remained a mind-boggling concept. Even so, according to the Bible, the fact that it did occur is not in any doubt. Every attribute of God, says the New Testament, is found in Jesus Christ. Omniscience? In John 16:30, the Apostle John affirms of Jesus, "Now we can see that you know all things." Omnipresence. Jesus said in Matthew 28:20, "Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." And in Matthew 18:20, "Where two or three come together in my name, there am I with them." Omnipotence. "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me," Jesus said in Matthew 28:18. Eternality. John 1:1 declares of Jesus, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Immutability? Hebrews 13:8 says, "Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever." Also, the Old Testament paints a portrait of God by using such titles and descriptions as Alpha and Omega, Lord, Savior, King, Judge, Light, Rock, Redeemer, Shepherd, Creator, Giver of Life, Forgiver of Sin, and Speaker with Divine Authority. It's fascinating to note that in the New Testament, each and every one is applied to Jesus. Jesus said it all in John 14:7. "If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well." Loose translation? "When you look at the sketch of God from the Old Testament, you will see a likeness of me." 10. The fingerprint evidence. Did Jesus, and Jesus alone match the identity of the Messiah. It was an uneventful Saturday at the Hiller home in Chicago. Clarence Hiller spent the afternoon painting the trim on the outside of his two-story house on West 104th Street. By early evening, he and his family had retired to bed. However, what happened next would change criminal law in America forever. The Hillers woke in the early morning hours of September 19, 1910, and became suspicious that a gas light near their daughter's bedroom had gone out. Clarence went to investigate. His wife heard a quick succession of sounds: a scuffle, two men tumbling down the stairs, two gunshots, and the slamming of the front door. She emerged to find Clarence dead at the foot of the stairs. Police arrested Thomas Jennings, a convicted burglar, less than a mile away. There was blood on his clothes, and his left arm had been injured, both, he said, from falling on a streetcar. In his pocket, they found the same kind of gun that had been used to shoot Clarence Hiller, but they couldn't determine if it was the murder weapon. Knowing they needed more to convict Jennings, detectives scoured the inside of Hiller's home in a search for additional clues. One fact soon became obvious. The killer had entered through a rear kitchen window. Detectives went outside, and there, next to that window, forever imprinted in the white paint that the murder victim himself had so carefully applied to a railing only hours before his death, they found four clear fingerprints from someone's left hand. Fingerprint evidence was a new concept at the time, having been recently introduced at an international police exhibition in St. Louis. So far, fingerprints had never been used to convict anyone of murder in the United States. Despite strong objections by defense attorneys that such evidence was unscientific and inadmissible, four officers testified that the fingerprints in the paint perfectly matched those of Thomas Jennings and him alone. The jury found Jennings guilty. The Illinois Supreme Court upheld his conviction in an historic ruling, and he was later hanged. The premise behind fingerprint evidence is simple. Each individual has unique ridges on his or her fingers. When a print found on an object matches the pattern of ridges on a person's finger, investigators can conclude with scientific certainty that this specific individual has touched that object. In many criminal cases, fingerprint identification is the pivotal evidence. I remember covering a trial in which a single thumbprint found on the cellophane wrapper of a cigarette package was the determining factor in convicting a 20-year-old burglar of murdering a college co-ed. That's how conclusive fingerprint evidence can be. Okay, but what has this got to do with Jesus Christ? Simply this. There is another kind of evidence that's analogous to fingerprints and establishes to an astounding degree of certainty that Jesus is indeed the Messiah of Israel and the world. In the Jewish scriptures, which Christians call the Old Testament, there are several dozen major prophecies about the coming of the Messiah, who would be sent by God to redeem his people. In effect, these predictions formed a figurative fingerprint that only the Anointed One would be able to match. This way, the Israelites could rule out any impostors and validate the credentials of the authentic Messiah. The Greek word for Messiah is Christ. But was Jesus really the Christ? Did he miraculously fulfill these predictions that were written hundreds of years before he was born? And how do we know he was the only individual throughout history who fit the prophetic fingerprint? There are plenty of scholars with long strings of initials after their names whom I could have asked about this topic. However, I wanted to interview someone for whom this was more than just an abstract academic exercise, and that took me to a very unlikely setting in Southern California. The ninth interview. Louis S. Lapides, Master of Divinity, Master of Theology. Usually a church would be a natural location in which to question someone about a biblical issue, but there was something different about sitting down with Pastor Louis Lapides in the sanctuary of his congregation on the morning after Sunday worship services. This setting of pews and stained glass was not where you would expect to find a nice Jewish boy from Newark, New Jersey. Yet that's Lapides' background. For someone with his heritage, the question of whether Jesus is the long-anticipated Messiah goes beyond theory. It's intensely personal, and I had sought out Lapide so I could hear the story of his own investigation of this critical issue. Lapides earned a bachelor's degree in theology from Dallas Baptist University, as well as a Master of Divinity and a Master of Theology degree in Old Testament and Semitics from Talbot Theological Seminary. He served for a decade with Chosen People Ministries, talking about Jesus to Jewish college students. He has taught in the Bible department of Biola University and worked for 7 years as an instructor for Walk Through the Bible seminars. He is also the former president of a national network of 15 Messianic congregations. Slender and bespectacled, Lapides is soft-spoken but has a quick smile and ready laugh. He was upbeat and polite as he ushered me to a chair near the front of Beth Ariel Fellowship in Sherman Oaks, California. I didn't want to begin by debating biblical nuances. Instead, I started by inviting Lapides to tell me the story of his spiritual journey. He folded his hands in his lap, looked at the dark wood walls for a moment as he decided where to start, and then began unfolding an extraordinary tale that took us from Newark to Greenwich Village to Vietnam to Los Angeles, from skepticism to faith, from Judaism to Christianity, from Jesus as irrelevant to Jesus as Messiah. "As you know, I come from a Jewish family," he began. "I attended a conservative Jewish synagogue for 7 years in preparation for Bar Mitzvah. Although we considered those studies to be very important, our family's faith didn't affect our everyday life very much. We didn't stop work on the Sabbath. We didn't have a kosher home." He smiled. "However, on the high holy days, we attended the stricter Orthodox synagogue because somehow my dad felt that's where you went if you really wanted to get serious with God." When I interjected to ask what his parents had taught him about the Messiah, Lapide's answer was crisp. "It never came up," he said matter-of-factly. I was incredulous. In fact, I thought I had misunderstood him. "You're saying it wasn't even discussed?" I asked. "Never," he reiterated. "I don't even remember it being an issue in Hebrew school." This was amazing to me. "How about Jesus?" I asked. "Was he ever talked about? Was his name used?" "Only derogatorily," Lapides quipped. "Basically, he was never discussed. My impressions of Jesus came from seeing Catholic churches. There was the cross, the crown of thorns, the pierced side, the blood coming from his head. It didn't make any sense to me. Why would you worship a man on a cross with nails in his hands and his feet? I never once thought Jesus had any connection to the Jewish people. I just thought he was a god of the Gentiles." I suspected that Lapide's attitudes toward Christians had gone beyond mere confusion over their beliefs. "Did you believe Christians were at the root of anti-Semitism?" I asked. "Gentiles were looked upon as synonymous with Christians, and we were taught to be cautious because there could be anti-Semitism among the Gentiles," he said, sounding a bit diplomatic. I pursued the issue further. "Would you say you developed some negative attitudes toward Christians?" This time he didn't mince words. "Yes, actually I did," he said. "In fact, later, when the New Testament was first presented to me, I sincerely thought it was going to basically be a handbook on anti-Semitism, how to hate Jews, how to kill Jews, how to massacre them. I thought the American Nazi Party would have been very comfortable using it as a guidebook." I shook my head, saddened at the thought of how many other Jewish children have grown up thinking of Christians as their enemies. A spiritual quest begins. Lapides said several incidents dimmed his allegiance to Judaism as he was growing up. Curious about the details, I asked him to elaborate, and he immediately turned to what was clearly the most heart-rending episode of his life. "My parents got divorced when I was 17," he said. And surprisingly, even after all these years, I could still detect hurt in his voice. "That really put a stake in any religious heart I may have had. I wondered, where does God come in? Why didn't they go to a rabbi for counseling? What good is religion if it can't help people in a practical way? It sure couldn't keep my parents together. When they split up, part of me split as well. On top of that, in Judaism, I didn't feel as if I had a personal relationship with God. I had a lot of beautiful ceremonies and traditions, But he was the distant and detached God of Mount Sinai who said, "Here are the rules. You'll live by them. You'll be okay. I'll see you later." And there I was, an adolescent with raging hormones, wondering, does God relate to my struggles? Does he care about me as an individual? Well, not in any way I could see. The divorce prompted an era of rebellion. Consumed with music and influenced by the writings of Jack Kerouac and Timothy Leary, he spent too much time in Greenwich Village coffee houses to go to college, making him vulnerable to the draft. By 1967, he found himself on the other side of the world in a cargo boat whose volatile freight, ammunition, bombs, rockets, and other high explosives, made it a tempting target for the Viet Cong. I remember being told at our orientation in Vietnam, 20% of you will probably get killed, and the other 80% will probably get a venereal disease or become alcoholics or get hooked on drugs. I thought, I don't even have a 1% chance of coming out normal. It was a very dark period. I witnessed suffering. I saw body bags. I saw the devastation from war. And I encountered anti-Semitism among some of the GIs. A few of them from the South even burned a cross one night. I probably wanted to distance myself from my Jewish identity. Maybe that's why I began delving into Eastern religions. Lapides read books on Eastern philosophies and visited Buddhist temples while in Japan. I was extremely bothered by the evil I had seen, and I was trying to figure out how faith can deal with it, he told me. I used to say, if there's a God, I don't care if I find him on Mount Sinai or Mount Fuji. I'll take him either way. He survived Vietnam, returning home with a newfound taste for marijuana and plans to become a Buddhist priest. He tried to live an ascetic lifestyle of self-denial in an effort to work off the bad karma for the misdeeds of his past, but soon he realized he'd never be able to make up for all his wrongs. Lapides was quiet for a moment. I got depressed, he said. I remember getting on the subway and thinking, maybe jumping onto the tracks is the answer. I could free myself from this body and just merge with God. I was very confused. To make matters worse, I started experimenting with LSD. Looking for a new start, he decided to move to California, where his spiritual quest continued. I went to Buddhist meetings, but that was empty. Chinese Buddhism was atheistic. Japanese Buddhism worshipped statues of Buddha. Zen Buddhism was too elusive. I went to Scientology meetings, but they were too manipulative and controlling. Hinduism believed in all these crazy orgies that the gods would have, and in gods who were blue elephants. None of it made sense. None of it was satisfying. He even accompanied friends to meetings that had satanic undercurrents. I would watch and think, something is going on here, but it's not good, he said. In the midst of my drug-crazed world, I told my friends I believed there's a power of evil that's beyond me, that can work in me, that exists as an entity. I had seen enough evil in my life to believe that. He looked at me with an ironic smile. I guess I accepted Satan's existence before I accepted God's. I can't believe in Jesus. It was 1969. Lapide's curiosity prompted him to visit Sunset Strip to gawk at an evangelist who had chained himself to an 8-foot cross to protest the way local tavern owners had managed to get him evicted from his storefront ministry. There on the sidewalk, Lapides encountered some Christians who engaged him in an impromptu spiritual debate. A bit cocky, he started throwing Eastern philosophy at them. "There is no God out there," he said, gesturing toward the heavens. "We're God. I'm God, you're God. You just have to realize it." "Well, if you're God, why don't you create a rock?" one person replied. "Just make something appear. That's what God does." In his drug-addled mind, Lapides imagined he was holding a rock. "Yeah, well, here's a rock," he said, extending his empty hand. The Christian scoffed. "That's the difference between you and the true God," he said. "When God creates something, everyone can see it. It's objective, not subjective." That registered with Lapides. After thinking about it for a while, he said to himself, "If I find God, he's got to be objective. I'm through with this Eastern philosophy that says it's all in my mind and that I can create my own reality. God has to be an objective reality if he's going to have any meaning beyond my own imagination. When one of the Christians brought up the name of Jesus, Lapides tried to fend him off with his stock answer, "I'm Jewish. I can't believe in Jesus." A pastor spoke up. "Do you know the prophecies about the Messiah?" he asked. Lapides was taken off guard. "Prophecies? I've never heard of them." The minister startled Lapides by referring to some of the Old Testament predictions. "Wait a minute," Lapides thought. "Those are my Jewish scriptures he's quoting. How could Jesus be in there?" When the pastor offered him a Bible, Lapides was skeptical. "Is the New Testament in there?" he asked. The pastor nodded. "Okay, I'll read the Old Testament, but I'm not going to open up the other one," Lapides told him. He was taken aback by the minister's response. "Fine," said the pastor. "Just read the Old Testament and ask the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel, to show you if Jesus is the Messiah, because he is your Messiah. He came to the Jewish people initially, and then he was also the Savior of the world." To Lapides, this was new information, intriguing information, astonishing information. So he went back to his apartment, opened the Old Testament to its first book, Genesis, and went hunting for Jesus among words that had been written hundreds of years before the carpenter of Nazareth had ever been born. "Pierced for our transgressions." "Pretty soon," Lapides told me, "I was reading the Old Testament every day and seeing one prophecy after another. For instance, Deuteronomy talked about a prophet greater than Moses who will come and whom we should listen to. I thought, who can be greater than Moses? It sounded like the Messiah, someone as great and as respected as Moses, but a greater teacher and a greater authority. I grabbed a hold of that and went searching for him." As Lapides progressed through the scriptures, he was stopped cold by Isaiah 53. With clarity and specificity, in a haunting prediction wrapped in exquisite poetry, here was the picture of a Messiah who would suffer and die for the sins of Israel and the world, all written more than 700 years before Jesus walked the earth. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. For he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. Isaiah 53:3-9 and 12. Instantly, Lapides recognized the portrait. This was Jesus of Nazareth. Now he was beginning to understand the paintings he had seen in the Catholic churches he had passed as a child. The suffering Jesus, the crucified Jesus, the Jesus who he now realized had been pierced for our transgressions as he bore the sin of many. As Jews in the Old Testament sought to atone for their sins through a system of animal sacrifices, here was Jesus, the ultimate sacrificial Lamb of God, who paid for sin once and for all. Here was the personification of God's plan of redemption. So breathtaking was this discovery that Lapides could only come to one conclusion. It was a fraud. He believed that Christians had rewritten the Old Testament and twisted Isaiah's words to make it sound as if the prophet had been foreshadowing Jesus. Lapides set out to expose the deception. I asked my stepmother to send me a Jewish Bible so I could check it out myself, he told me. She did, and guess what? I found that it said the same thing. Now I really had to deal with it. The Jewishness of Jesus. Over and over, Lapides would come upon prophecies in the Old Testament, more than 4 dozen major predictions in all. Isaiah revealed the manner of the Messiah's birth, of a virgin. Micah pinpointed the place of his birth, Bethlehem. Genesis and Jeremiah specified his ancestry, a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, from the tribe of Judah, the house of David. The Psalms foretold his betrayal, his accusation by false witnesses, his manner of death, pierced in the hands and feet, although crucifixion hadn't been invented yet, and his resurrection. He would not decay, but would ascend on high, and on, each one chipped away at Lapide's skepticism until he was finally willing to take a drastic step. I decided to open the New Testament and just read the first page, he said. With trepidation, I slowly turned to Matthew as I looked up to heaven, waiting for the lightning bolt to strike. Matthew's initial words leaped off the page. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Lapide's eyes widened as he recalled the moment he first read that sentence. I thought, wow, son of Abraham, son of David, it was all fitting together. I went to the birth narratives and thought, look at this. Matthew is quoting from Isaiah 7:14, the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son. And then I saw him quoting from the prophet Jeremiah. I sat there thinking, you know, this is about Jewish people. Where do the Gentiles come in? What's going on here? I couldn't put it down. I read through the rest of the Gospels, and I realized this wasn't a handbook for the American Nazi Party. It was an interaction between Jesus and the Jewish community. I got to the book of Acts, and this was incredible. They were trying to figure out how the Jews could bring the story of Jesus to the Gentiles. Talk about role reversal. So convincing were the fulfilled prophecies that Lapides started telling people that he thought Jesus was the Messiah. At the time, this was merely an intellectual possibility to him, yet its implications were deeply troubling. I realized that if I were to accept Jesus into my life, there would have to be some significant changes in the way I was living, he explained. I'd have to deal with the drugs, the sex, and so forth. I didn't understand that God would help me make those changes. I thought I had to clean up my life on my own. Epiphany in the Desert. Lapides and some friends headed into the Mojave Desert for a getaway. Spiritually, he was feeling conflicted. He had been unsettled by nightmares of being torn apart by dogs pulling at him from opposite directions. Sitting among the desert scrub, he recalled the words someone had spoken to him on Sunset Strip. You're either on God's side or on Satan's side. He believed in the embodiment of evil, and that's not whose side he wanted to be on. So Lapides prayed, God, I've got to come to the end of this struggle. I have to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus is the Messiah. I need to know that you, as the God of Israel, want me to believe this. As he related the story to me, Lapides hesitated, unsure how to put into words what happened next. A few moments passed. Then he told me, the best I can put together out of that experience is that God objectively spoke to my heart. He convinced me, experientially, that he exists. And at that point, out in the desert, in my heart, I said, God, I accept Jesus into my life. I don't understand what I'm supposed to do with him, but I want him. I've pretty much made a mess of my life. I need you to change me. And God began to do that in a process that continues to this day. My friends knew my life had changed, and they couldn't understand it, he said. They'd say, something happened to you in the desert. You don't want to do drugs anymore. There's something different about you. I would say, well, I can't explain what happened. All I know is that there's someone in my life, and it's someone who's holy, who's righteous, who's a source of positive thoughts about life, and I just feel whole. That last word, it seemed, said everything. Whole. he emphasized to me, in a way I had never felt before. Despite the positive changes, he was concerned about breaking the news to his parents. When he finally did, reaction was mixed. At first, they were joyful because they could tell I was no longer dependent on drugs, and I sounded much better emotionally, he recalled. But that began to unravel when they understood the source of all the changes. They winced, as if to say, "Why does it have to be Jesus? Why can't it be something else?" They didn't know what to do with it. With a trace of sadness in his voice, he added, "I'm still not sure they really do." Through a remarkable string of circumstances, Lapid's prayer for a wife was answered when he met Deborah, who was also Jewish and a follower of Jesus. She took him to her church, the same one, it turned out, that was pastored by the minister who many months earlier on Sunset Strip had challenged Lapid's to read the Old Testament. Lapid's laughed. "I'll tell you what, his jaw dropped open when he saw me walk into the church." That congregation was filled with ex-bikers, ex-hippies, and ex-addicts from the Strip, along with a spattering of transplanted Southerners. For a young Jewish man from Newark who was relationally gun-shy with people who were different from him because of the anti-Semitism he feared he would encounter, it was healing to learn to call such a diverse crowd brothers and sisters. Lapid's married Deborah a year after they met. Since then, she has given birth to two sons, and together they've given birth to Beth Ariel Fellowship, a home for Jews and Gentiles who also are finding wholeness in Christ. Responding to objections. Lapid's finished his story and relaxed in his chair. I let the moment linger. The sanctuary was peaceful. The stained glass was glowing red and yellow and blue from the California sun. I sat musing over the power of one person's story of a faith found. I marveled at this saga of war and drugs, of Greenwich Village and Sunset Strip and a barren desert, none of which I ever would have associated with the pleasant, well-adjusted minister sitting in front of me. But I didn't want to ignore the obvious questions that his story raised. With Lapid's permission, I started by asking the one that was foremost on my mind. If the prophecies were so obvious to you and pointed so unquestionably toward Jesus, why don't more Jews accept him as their Messiah? It was a question Lapid's had asked himself a lot during the 3 decades since he was challenged by a Christian to investigate the Jewish scriptures. "In my case, I took the time to read them," he replied. "Oddly enough, even though the Jewish people are known for having high intellects, in this area there's a lot of ignorance. Plus, you have counter-missionary organizations that hold seminars in synagogues to try to disprove the messianic prophecies. Jewish people hear them and use them as an excuse for not exploring the prophecies personally. They'll say, 'The rabbi told me there's nothing to this.' I'll ask them, 'Do you think the rabbi just brought up an objection that Christianity has never heard before? I mean, scholars have been working on this for hundreds of years. There's great literature out there and powerful Christian answers to those challenges.' If they're interested, I help them go further." I wondered about the ostracism a Jewish person faces if he or she becomes a Christian. That's definitely a factor. Some people won't let the messianic prophecies grab them because they're afraid of the repercussions, potential rejection by their family and the Jewish community. That's not easy to face, believe me, I know. Even so, some of the challenges to the prophecies sound pretty convincing when a person first hears them. So one by one, I posed the most common objections to Lapid's to see how he would respond. 1. The coincidence argument. First, I asked Lapid's whether it's possible that Jesus merely fulfilled the prophecies by accident. Maybe he's just one of many throughout history who have coincidentally fit the prophetic fingerprint. "Not a chance," came his response. "The odds are so astronomical that they rule that out. Someone did the math and figured out that the probability of just 8 prophecies being fulfilled is 1 chance in 100 million billion. That number is millions of times greater than the total number of people who've ever walked the planet." He calculated that if you took this number of silver dollars, they would cover the state of Texas to a depth of 2 feet. If you marked 1 silver dollar among them and then had a blindfolded person wander the whole state and bend down to pick up 1 coin, What would be the odds he'd choose the one that had been marked? With that, he answered his own question. The same odds that anybody in history could have fulfilled just 8 of the prophecies. I had studied this same statistical analysis by mathematician Peter W. Stoner when I was investigating the messianic prophecies for myself. Stoner also computed that the probability of fulfilling 48 prophecies was 1 chance in a trillion, 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 trillion. Our minds can't comprehend a number that big. This is a staggering statistic that's equal to the number of minuscule atoms in a trillion, 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 billion universes the size of our universe. The odds alone say it would be impossible for anyone to fulfill the Old Testament prophecies, Lapides concluded. Yet Jesus, and only Jesus throughout all of history, managed to do it. The words of the Apostle Peter popped into my head. But the things which God announced beforehand by the mouth of all the prophets that his Christ should suffer, he has thus fulfilled. Acts 3:18. 2. The altered gospel argument. I painted another scenario for Lapides, asking, isn't it possible that the gospel writers fabricated details to make it appear that Jesus fulfilled the prophecies? For example, I said, the prophecies say the Messiah's bones would remain unbroken. So maybe John invented the story about the Romans breaking the legs of the 2 thieves being crucified with Jesus and not breaking his legs. And the prophecies talk about betrayal for 30 pieces of silver. So maybe Matthew played fast and loose with the facts and said, yeah, Judas sold out Jesus for that same amount. But that objection didn't fly any further than the previous one. In God's wisdom, he created checks and balances both inside and outside the Christian community, Lapides explained. When the Gospels were being circulated, there were people living who had been around when all these things happened. Someone would have said to Matthew, you know, it didn't happen that way. We're trying to communicate a life of righteousness and truth, so don't taint it with a lie. Besides, he added, why would Matthew have fabricated fulfilled prophecies and then willingly allowed himself to be put to death for following someone who he secretly knew was really not the Messiah? That wouldn't make any sense. What's more, the Jewish community would have jumped on any opportunity to discredit the Gospels by pointing out falsehoods. They would have said, I was there and Jesus' bones were broken by the Romans during the crucifixion, Lapides said. But even though the Jewish Talmud refers to Jesus in derogatory ways, it never once makes the claim that the fulfillment of prophecies was falsified. Not one time. 3. The intentional fulfillment argument. Some skeptics have asserted that Jesus merely maneuvered his life in a way to fulfill the prophecies. Couldn't he have read in Zechariah that the Messiah would ride a donkey into Jerusalem and then arrange to do exactly that? I asked. Lapides made a small concession. For a few of the prophecies, yes, that's certainly conceivable, he said. But there are many others for which this just wouldn't have been possible. For instance, how would he control the fact that the Sanhedrin offered Judas 30 pieces of silver to betray him? How could he arrange for his ancestry, or the place of his birth, or his method of execution, or that soldiers gambled for his clothing, or that his legs remained unbroken on the cross? How would he arrange to perform miracles in front of skeptics? How would he arrange for his resurrection? And how would he arrange to be born when he was? That last comment piqued my curiosity. What do you mean by when he was born? When you interpret Daniel 9:24-26, it foretells that the Messiah would appear a certain length of time after King Artaxerxes I issued a decree for the Jewish people to go from Persia to rebuild the walls in Jerusalem, Lapides replied. He leaned forward to deliver the clincher. That puts the anticipated appearance of the Messiah at the exact moment in history when Jesus showed up. Certainly, that's nothing he could have prearranged. 4. The context argument. One other objection needed to be addressed. Were the passages that Christians identify as messianic prophecies really intended to point to the coming of the Anointed One, or do Christians rip them out of context and misinterpret them? Lapides sighed. You know, I go through the books that people write to try to tear down what we believe. That's not fun to do. But I spend the time to look at each objection individually, and then to research the context and the wording in the original language. And every single time, the prophecies have stood up and shown themselves to be true. So here's my challenge to skeptics. Don't accept my word for it, but don't accept your rabbi's either. Spend the time to research it yourself. Today, nobody can say there's no information. There are plenty of books out there to help you. And one more thing. Sincerely ask God to show you whether or not Jesus is the Messiah. That's what I did. And without any coaching, it became clear to me who fit the fingerprint of the Messiah. Everything must be fulfilled. I appreciated the way Lapides had responded to the objections, but ultimately it was the story of his spiritual journey that kept replaying in my mind as I flew back to Chicago late that night. I reflected on how many times I had encountered similar stories, especially among successful and thoughtful Jewish people who had specifically set out to refute Jesus' messianic claims. I thought about Stan Telkin, the East Coast businessman who had embarked on a quest to expose the cult of Christianity after his daughter went away to college and received Yeshua, Jesus, as her Messiah. He was astonished to find that his investigation led him and his wife and second daughter to the same Messiah. He later became a Christian minister, and his book that recounts his story, Betrayed, has been translated into more than 20 languages. There was Jack Sternberg, a prominent cancer physician in Little Rock, Arkansas, who was so alarmed at what he found in the Old Testament that he challenged three rabbis to disprove that Jesus was the Messiah. They couldn't, and he too has claimed to have found wholeness in Christ. And there was Peter Greenspan, an obstetrician gynecologist who practices in the Kansas City area and is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Medicine. Like Lapides, he had been challenged to look for Jesus in Judaism. What he found troubled him, so he went to the Torah and Talmud, seeking to discredit Jesus' messianic credentials. Instead, he concluded that Jesus did miraculously fulfill the prophecies. For him, the more he read books by those trying to undermine the evidence for Jesus as the Messiah, the more he saw the flaws in their arguments. Ironically, concluded Greenspan, I think I actually came to faith in Yeshua by reading what detractors wrote. He found, as have Lapides and others, that Jesus' words in the Gospel of Luke have proved true. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. Luke 24:44. It was fulfilled, and only in Jesus, the sole individual in history who has matched the prophetic fingerprint of God's Anointed One. Part 3. Researching the Resurrection. 11. The Medical Evidence. Was Jesus' death a sham and his resurrection a hoax? I paused to read the plaque hanging in the waiting room of a doctor's office. Let conversation cease, let laughter flee. This is the place where death delights to help the living. Obviously, this was no ordinary physician. I was paying another visit to Dr. Robert J. Stein, one of the world's foremost forensic pathologists, a flamboyant, husky-voiced medical detective who used to regale me with stories about the unexpected clues he had uncovered while examining corpses. For him, dead men did tell tales. In fact, tales that would often bring justice to the living. During his lengthy tenure as medical examiner of Cook County, Illinois, Stein performed more than 20,000 autopsies, each time meticulously searching for insights into the circumstances surrounding the victim's death. Repeatedly, his sharp eye for detail, his encyclopedic knowledge of the human anatomy, and his uncanny investigative intuition helped this medical sleuth reconstruct the victim's violent demise. Sometimes, innocent people were vindicated as a result of his findings. But more often, Stein's work was the final nail in a defendant's coffin. Such was the case with John Wayne Gacy, who faced the executioner after Stein helped convict him of 33 grisly murders. That's how crucial medical evidence can be. It can determine whether a child died of abuse or an accidental fall. It can establish whether a person succumbed to natural causes or was murdered by someone who spiked the person's coffee with arsenic. It can uphold or dismantle a defendant's alibi by pinpointing the victim's time of death, using an ingenious procedure that measures the amount of potassium in the eyes of the deceased. And, yes, even in the case of someone brutally executed on a Roman cross 2 millennia ago, medical evidence can still make a crucial contribution. It can destroy one of the most persistent arguments used by those who claim that the resurrection of Jesus, the supreme vindication of his claim to deity, was nothing more than an elaborate hoax. Resurrection or resuscitation? The idea that Jesus never really died on the cross can be found in the Quran, which was written in the 7th century. In fact, Ahmadiyya Muslims contend that Jesus actually fled to India. To this day, there's a shrine that supposedly marks his real burial place in Srinagar, Kashmir. As the 19th century dawned, Karl Barth, Carl Venturini, and others tried to explain away the resurrection by suggesting that Jesus only fainted from exhaustion on the cross, or he had been given a drug that made him appear to die, and that he had later been revived by the cool, damp air of the tomb. Conspiracy theorists bolstered this hypothesis by pointing out that Jesus had been given some liquid on a sponge while on the cross, Mark 15:36, and that Pilate seemed surprised at how quickly Jesus had succumbed, Mark 15:44. Consequently, they said, Jesus' reappearance wasn't a miraculous resurrection, but merely a fortuitous resuscitation, and his tomb was empty because he continued to live. While reputable scholars have repudiated this so-called swoon theory, it keeps recurring in popular literature. In 1929, D.H. Lawrence wove this theme into a short story in which he suggested that Jesus had fled to Egypt, where he fell in love with the priestess Isis. In 1965, Hugh Schoenfield's bestseller, The Passover Plot, alleged that it was only the unanticipated stabbing of Jesus by the Roman soldier that foiled his complicated scheme to escape the cross alive, even though Schoenfield conceded, "We are nowhere claiming that the book represents what actually happened." The swoon hypothesis popped up again in Donovan Joyce's 1972 book, The Jesus Scroll, which contains an even more incredible string of improbabilities than Schoenfield's, according to resurrection expert Gary Habermas. In 1982, Holy Blood, Holy Grail added the twist that Pontius Pilate had been bribed to allow Jesus to be taken down from the cross before he was dead. Even so, the authors confessed, "We could not, and still cannot, prove the accuracy of our conclusion." As recently as 1992, a little-known academic from Australia, Barbara Thiering, caused a stir by reviving the swoon theory in her book Jesus and the Riddle of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was introduced with much fanfare by a well-respected U.S. publisher and then derisively dismissed by Emory University scholar Luke Timothy Johnson as being the purest poppycock, the product of fevered imagination rather than careful analysis. Like an urban myth, the swoon theory continues to flourish. I hear it all the time in discussing the resurrection with spiritual seekers, but what does the evidence really establish? What actually happened at the crucifixion? What was Jesus' cause of death? Is there any possible way he could have survived this ordeal? Those are the kinds of questions that I hoped medical evidence could help resolve. So I flew to Southern California and knocked on the door of a prominent physician who has extensively studied the historical, archaeological, and medical data concerning the death of Jesus of Nazareth, although it seems that, due to the mysteriously missing body, no autopsy has ever been performed. The 10th interview. Alexander Metherell, M.D., Ph.D. The plush setting was starkly incongruous with the subject we were discussing. There we were, sitting in the living room of Metherell's comfortable California home on a balmy spring evening, warm ocean breezes whispering through the windows while we were talking about a topic of unimaginable brutality, a beating so barbarous that it shocks the conscience, and a form of capital punishment so depraved that it stands as wretched testimony to man's inhumanity to man. I had sought out Metherell because I heard he possessed the medical and scientific credentials to explain the crucifixion. But I also had another motivation. I had been told he could discuss the topic dispassionately as well as accurately. That was important to me, because I wanted the facts to speak for themselves without the hyperbole or charged language that might otherwise manipulate emotions. As you would expect from someone with a medical degree, University of Miami in Florida, and a doctorate in engineering, University of Bristol in England, Metherell speaks with scientific precision. He is board certified in diagnosis by the American Board of Radiology and has been a consultant to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the National Institutes of Health of Bethesda, Maryland. A former research scientist who has taught at the University of California, Metherell is editor of 5 scientific books and has written for publications ranging from Aerospace Medicine to Scientific American. His ingenious analysis of muscular contraction has been published in the Physiologist and Biophysics Journal. He even looks the role of a distinguished medical authority. He's an imposing figure with silver hair and a courteous yet formal demeanor. I'll be honest. At times I wondered what was going on inside Metherell. With scientific reserve, speaking slowly and methodically, he gave no hint of any inner turmoil as he calmly described the chilling details of Jesus' demise. Whatever was going on underneath, whatever distress it caused him as a Christian to talk about the cruel fate that befell Jesus, he was able to mask with a professionalism born out of decades of laboratory research. He just gave me the facts. And after all, that was what I had traveled halfway across the country to get. The torture before the cross. Initially, I wanted to elicit from Metherell a basic description of the events leading up to Jesus' death. So after a time of social chat, I put down my iced tea and shifted in my chair to face him squarely. "Could you paint a picture of what happened to Jesus?" I asked. He cleared his throat. "It began after the Last Supper," he said. "Jesus went with his disciples to the Mount of Olives, specifically to the Garden of Gethsemane, and there, if you remember, he prayed all night. Now, during that process, he was anticipating the coming events of the next day. Since he knew the amount of suffering he was going to have to endure, he was quite naturally experiencing a great deal of psychological stress." I raised my hand to stop him. "Whoa, whoa. Here's where skeptics have a field day," I told him. "The Gospels tell us he began to sweat blood at this point. Now, come on. Isn't that just a product of some overactive imaginations? Doesn't that call into question the accuracy of the Gospel writers?" Unfazed, Metherell shook his head. "Not at all," he replied. "This is a known medical condition called hematidrosis. It's not very common, but it is associated with a high degree of psychological stress. What happens is that severe anxiety causes the release of chemicals that break down the capillaries in the sweat glands. As a result, there's a small amount of bleeding into these glands, and the sweat comes out tinged with blood. We're not talking about a lot of blood. It's just a very, very small amount." Though a bit chastened, I pressed on. "Did this have any other effect on the body?" "What this did was set up the skin to be extremely fragile, so that when Jesus was flogged by the Roman soldier the next day, his skin would be very, very sensitive." Well, I thought, here we go. I braced myself for the grim images I knew were about to flood my mind. I had seen plenty of dead bodies as a journalist, casualties of car accidents, fires, and crime syndicate retribution. But there was something especially unnerving in hearing about someone being intentionally brutalized by executioners determined to extract maximum suffering. "Tell me," I said, "what was the flogging like?" Metherell's eyes never left me. Roman floggings were known to be terribly brutal. They usually consisted of 39 lashes, but frequently were a lot more than that, depending on the mood of the soldier applying the blows. The soldier would use a whip of braided leather thongs with metal balls woven into them. When the whip would strike the flesh, these balls would cause deep bruises or contusions, which would break open with further blows. And the whip had pieces of sharp bone as well, which would cut the flesh severely. The back would be so shredded that parts of the spine were sometimes exposed by the deep, deep cuts. The whipping would have gone all the way from the shoulders down to the back, the buttocks, and the back of the legs. It was just terrible. Metherell paused. Go on. One physician who has studied Roman beating said, as the flogging continued, the lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. A 3rd-century historian by the name of Eusebius described a flogging by saying, the sufferer's veins were laid bare, and the very muscles, sinews, and bowels of the victim were open to exposure. We know that many people would die from this kind of beating even before they would be crucified. At the least, the victim would experience tremendous pain and go into hypovolemic shock. Metherell had thrown in a medical term I didn't know. What does hypovolemic shock mean? I asked. Hypo means low, vol refers to volume, and emic means blood, so hypovolemic shock means the person is suffering the effects of losing a large amount of blood, the doctor explained. This does 4 things. First, the heart races to try to pump blood that isn't there. Second, the blood pressure drops, causing fainting or collapse. Third, the kidneys stop producing urine to maintain what volume is left. And fourth, the person becomes very thirsty as the body craves fluids to replace the lost blood volume. Do you see evidence of this in the gospel accounts? Yes, most definitely. Jesus was in hypovolemic shock as he staggered up the road to the execution site at Calvary, carrying the horizontal beam of the cross. Finally, Jesus collapsed, and the Roman soldier ordered Simon to carry the cross for him. Later we read that Jesus said, "I thirst," at which point a sip of vinegar was offered to him. Because of the terrible effects of this beating, there's no question that Jesus was already in serious to critical condition even before the nails were driven through his hands and feet.
This concludes this disc. Please proceed to Disc 8 for the continuation of the program.